Here we go. Welcome to the Repossible Podcast. I'm your host, Bradley Charbonneau. I'm here today with Dan Hill, the author of Famous Faces Decoded. And before I even attempt to try to explain what he's writing about and talking about, he just explained it a little to me, and I wanted to hit record so he can explain it and I could just listen in, because it's just fascinating. And so, if Dan, if you want to give yourself a little intro and tell us a bit about facial decoding, I'd love to hear from you. Glad to have you.
Sure. No, happy to be here, Bradley. Yes, my name is Dan Hill, and in 1998, my life was transformed when someone at IBM sent over an article about the breakthroughs in brain science and how much we are intuitive, emotional decision makers. The fact that the conservative scientific estimation is that at least 95% of our mental activity is not fully conscious. Talk about a game changer. Well, it changed my life, and my hands were literally trembling when I finished reading the article, and I said, this is so cool. This is the intellectual gold rush of our era. And then I set off on the proposition to say, how am I going to possibly capture and quantify emotional responses? And that led me to facial coding.
Wow. So in the book, I see images, and you're talking about you're pointing arrows at parts of the face, and so you, well, your description of the book title is very descriptive. You're decoding. So what can the average mortal like me, is this something that we can learn? And then if it is, what can we do with it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You can learn it. There are, you know, it's not infinitesimally complicated. There are 23 key expressions that correspond to 7 emotions. Someone once said that there are only, at least in the Western world, in America, there are only 2 currencies, dollars and emotions, or you can say euros and emotions. But these are things that go around and come around. And so those 7 core emotions that facial coding can detect are happiness, surprise, anger, fear, sadness, disgust, and contempt. And where they show is particularly in the middle of the face. I often say that Leonardo da Vinci was the world's original facial coder. He became fascinated with anatomy, and so he started studying which muscle movements corresponded to which emotions, and that helped inform Mona Lisa. One of the reasons why that painting is so fascinating is that we too often just shorthand say, you know, a Mona Lisa smile. Yeah. Well, frankly, her smile is the least of it. Mona Lisa also happens to show contempt. The corner of her mouth is lifting up and away in a bit of a snide reaction. She is also has a upper chin thrust, which reveals anger and disgust and sadness. And there's a little bit of anger also around the eye. The lower eyelid is taut and straight. So happiness is actually a rather small proportion of what Mona Lisa is showing. And that's just one instance. This can go on and on. And I'm happy to go into more details.
But that's also crazy thinking that, okay, sure, our physical features on our face, I can, you know, move my lip and I can squint my eyes and stuff. But to think of the painter and being able to get that through, that's amazing.
Well, and just to stick with Da Vinci for a moment, I mean, the guy was, of course, a perfectionist. It took him as long to do, and he kept fiddling with the painting the rest of his life, but the initial 4 years of painting it was as long as Michelangelo took to do the entire Sistine Chapel ceiling. So it was a pretty obsessive work, but it made him a great facial coder. And the next person who came along really to lift this game was Charles Darwin. Darwin was the first scientist to take emotions seriously. He said if they didn't matter to us, excuse me, they would have been weaned out of us over the course of evolution. And Darwin came to realize that in your face, you best reflect and communicate your emotions. One, it's universal. Even a person born blind emotes the same way as you or I. Second, it's real time. Wow. The face is the only place in the body where the muscles attach right to the skin. And third, it's abundant. We have more facial muscles than any other species on the planet. So it's just this wealth of information sitting right in the middle of our face, which is why it's been said that the richest, again, the richest 25 square inches of visual territory in the world is in the middle of the face, featuring the eyes, nose, and mouth region. It is just a great opportunity to understand yourself, to understand other people you're interacting with, to take in films and media and TV shows in a completely new way. If you want to talk about what's repossible or possible in life, this opens completely new avenues, quite frankly. It did it for me personally. It did it for me professionally. I think you can do it for every single listener in your career, in your personal life.
So we can learn some things. But if you say, so if many of our facial expressions are not conscious, the majority, right?
They happen. It's almost like a wave breaking on a shore. I mean, typically your emotional response is going to be, you know, anywhere from a fraction of a second to, you know, if it's really a prolonged reaction, it might last 3 to 4 seconds on the face, but that's not so common actually.
And so is this something like how to read people? I mean, is this something like the police? I can think of like film noir, like the light bulb down on the bad guy. And he's, you know, interviewing, like, did you do it? And is this, am I in the right direction with thinking how I could read someone like that?
It can go that far. I'll give you a little story example. So I'm in China. I'm going to be speaking at the Chamber of Commerce in Beijing the next day. I took a little tour up to the Great Wall.
Not recently, apparently.
Not recently, and some years ago now. And there's a guy on the tour, and we fall into conversation. And like a typical American, he says, "What do you do for a living?" Right. You know, if you're in France, they might say, "What's your favorite wine?" or something. But you're American. It's what's your career? Right. So I said, "Well, I'm a market researcher." He looked really bored, so I spiced it up and said, "Well, actually, I'm a facial coder." And he goes, "Ooh. Oh, micro expressions." And I go, "Well, that's not exactly a household term." I said, "Now you have to tell me what you do for a living." And he said, "Well, officially, I work for Halliburton." He said, "Unofficially, and in truth, I'm the substation chief for the CIA in Saudi Arabia, and I have used facial coding for 15 years for surveillance and interrogation purposes." And I think the only reason he told me that is because he was a Canadian, in fact, and fairly disgusted with everything he had learned about the world in his time. And he was retiring and going back to Toronto. And I think that's the only reason he confessed that to me.
Wow. And so like some CIA interrogator, this would be very handy for them.
Yes. And this will go a lot of directions. And I got into it because I thought this was really a wonderful tool, frankly, to, you know, maybe I could make a career at it. Maybe I couldn't. I actually did. I managed to do work for more than half the world's top 100 B2C companies, but I never expected that going in. I just thought it was intellectually interesting and I couldn't resist. Yeah. But you know, once I got into it, my real goal was to try to humanize business, to get companies to show more respect and understanding of the customer experience in their interactions with them. And I think that's a very valid use. Now that I'm essentially retired, I wrote Famous Faces Decoded to say, let me share the secret sauce so everyone can apply this, whether it's in their business life or their personal life, and have a better life as a result of that understanding. But yeah, I can't deny that there's a third element that I'm not as happy about in terms of where facial coding is likely to go. Yeah. And that's the fact that, yes, it can be used in surveillance. There is a Chinese company that has automated facial coding, just like the Silicon Valley companies are after this goal. And no doubt that's part of what the Chinese are using in the Northwest province, where the Uyghurs are being surveilled. So undergoing surveillance.
But do you mean surveillance more than just IDing, like recognizing?
Yes. You're really talking about a progression here. So what most people know about is that there is, you know, facial recognition, that is IDing who you are as a person. But what's happening for the Uyghurs is that once they are detained in these re-education camps, they also record video of how they're responding to, you can call it re-education, I think I would call it propaganda, how they're responding to this. And if they have adverse reactions, like they show anger, they're resistant to the messaging, they can be detained and held longer. So you're really talking about a progression that goes from emotional you know, a recognition of who you are. So that's identity recognition to emotion recognition, which is a different way of talking about facial coding. And all of this is going to be tied into AI. The Economist magazine in London has referred to the emerging facial industrial complex. Now, that's not why I got into this. I got into it for much more personal reasons. But there's a commercial application. There is a military surveillance, you know, deep state application. And then there's the one I favor, which is the personal application. So you can better understand yourself and the people you interact with, your loved ones, your colleagues at work, maybe on your next job search, you know, so on and so forth.
And so speaking of like the everyday non-CIA interrogator, yes. non-Halliburton Saudi Arabia attaché, how could it help the average Repossible listener? And I shouldn't even say that. Average, there is no average Repossible listener. Just kidding. How could it help us mortals? What could we do in sort of the everyday life aspect? Or like you say, if you related it to business or your small business, or I don't know, I'm in a sales meeting, or I want a job, or I want to get a date, or like real life examples. What would?
Yeah, no. Let's dive in. So, okay. Of these seven emotions, there are two that are the heavyweights, and they are anger and happiness. For most people, in many situations, they will constitute about 70% of the average person's emoting. Now, you might think happiness is really simple. They smile, end of story. Right. Well, actually, there are two different kinds of smiles. There's a social smile where it just involves the cheeks and the corners of the mouth lift. But a true smile is when the muscle around the eye relaxes and you get the twinkle in the eye. That's what I like to think that Woody Allen meant when he said, happiness makes up in height what it lacks in length. So the champagne moments is the joy, that true smile where they get the twinkle in the eye. But yeah, you know, smiles are used in lots of ways, including for camouflage. And so while it's true that we have these, you know, instinctive responses that happen, it doesn't mean that human beings don't try to be like animals in the wild to protect themselves. And a smile, in addition to going to a poker face or trying to go to a poker face, is the most typical reaction. So you might show some fear on the face or anger or something else, but you'll mask it with the smile. And you can tell that the smile is not so genuine for a couple of reasons. One is if it's lopsided. A lopsided smile is indication that you're kind of pulling the expression onto your face. You can also look at the rhythm of the smile. As I said, any expression should be like a wave that gathers, has a peak, and breaks in the shore. And this should happen quite quickly. With a not so genuine smile, one that you can see is that the smile comes on just too fast. It's what I call a light bulb smile. Another thing is that the smile might last too long. If someone laughs at your joke for more than 3 seconds, Bradley, they are brown-nosing you almost certainly. And finally, if the expression goes off too fast, this is what I call the guillotine smile. It just drops away. You know, politicians do this. You know, they'll flash the smile and then they just disappears all too quickly, kind of like they're putting it back in their pocket now that they've deployed it. So happiness, you might think, is fairly simple, but it's not. And anger is even more complicated. There are 9 different ways in which we show anger on the face. Sometimes the expression simply reveals anger. It's just a straight up proposition. Yeah. Other times with like Mona Lisa and that upward chin press, that will actually reveal more than one emotion. In that case, it's also disgust and sadness. But most typically, to just simplify it for the listener, think of these two emotions, happiness and anger, as follows. Happiness is, in essence, to hug, to embrace, to be open to new experiences. The essence of anger is to hit. You want to remove barriers to progress. You want to be in control of your circumstances. You are resentful. You are confused. Really, anger in many ways is about boundary setting, and you strike to reestablish those boundaries and to create opportunities for yourself. So it does have evolutionary advantages to being angry at times. But what you're looking for is things like the lips pressing together. If you're confused or concentrating, the eyebrows will narrow and pinch together, ultimately revealing a upward vertical crease between the eyebrows. The eyes can narrow. That's what I call snake eyes. So these are all possibilities. But anger is a very volatile, also potentially a very creative and empowering emotion. But it comes up all the time. And those two, if we say in business, there's an 80-20 rule where 80% of your profits will come from 20% of your clients. Well, this is the 70-30 rule. These two emotions will give you about 70% of all the emoting that goes on in people most commonly.
You know, as you were saying that, I was doing what you were saying. And then the brows are coming together. I'm putting my eyebrows together and I'm raising the corner of my mouth as you say it. And I realize as you do this, I raise, oh yeah, I guess I do that. And then I wonder how much consciously. And there's one particular person I'm thinking of. And when I speak, she looks at me like she's concerned. But I think she's just trying to understand what I'm saying or something. And maybe I'm self-conscious because I live in Holland. I speak Dutch. My Dutch is excellent. But then she starts making me feel self-conscious because I think maybe my Dutch isn't coming across so well with her. Maybe she's really struggling to understand. Maybe I need to enunciate. Maybe that was the wrong verb. And I'm reading her face and I'm hoping it's wrong because she looks so concerned, like, Bradley, this is really terrible news. I'm like, no, it's not terrible news. You're just struggling with my grammar or something. What's going on?
Well, and that is the ambiguous nature. Just because we can identify anger, then you have to kind of say, let me put it into context. So anger could be indeed really concentrating. I have a friend a bit like what you're describing.
Yeah.
And one time he said, I don't remember that you had this coat. And I said, oh, yes, you do, Paul. And I'll tell you why. Because I said, I put on the coat. And then I pulled out a cap, and the cap matched the coat. And I said, you showed a disgust expression in your face because you thought to yourself, my God, if his gloves match the coat and the hat, I'm going to barf because this is just too perfect, but you're perfect. And I said, that's why you remember this coat. And he went, oh, my God, you're right. But what I didn't tell him was that his upper lip curled in disgust when I put on the cap that matched the jacket. So it does reveal things people don't even recognize, but are helpful clues to navigate your moment.
So how has this helped you? And what are you doing with it further? So I'm a beginner and I'm fascinated. I'm going to go study up on it. But with you, how are you using this? What are you doing to now that I'm just going to assume you're an expert at this? How does that help you? What do you do? Do you offer trainings or courses, or do you help corporations, or
I have used it for 20 years in market research. And as you can imagine, it was also extremely helpful in my pitch meetings because you have to read the moment. I can remember being in Toronto and, of course, they had an incumbent market research firm they were using. And I knew I had pushed a little too hard at one point because he showed one of the versions of anger, which is you get a little bulge below the middle of your lower lip. And I saw it. I went, oh, crap. I pushed too hard. Wow. And the rest of the meeting, I tried as best I could to soften it and to be a little more likable and this and that. But he had that reaction, and he never took my return phone call, email, nothing happened. That was the telltale moment. And I knew it then, and it proved to be true. The meeting was essentially over, even though we kept talking for a while. So, all of us in life, quite honestly, have to sell. It could be our spouse. Like, I have this great idea for where we should go on our next vacation. Yeah. And you might be able to read on their face whether you have any real chance of talking them into going to Montenegro, for your next get-together and outing.
Yeah.
So it can certainly be in that. Job search, is this a place you really want to work? What's the personality of your boss as you are sitting in that meeting? So me, in my case, it was pitch meetings. But for other of us, we make our income because we're going to try to land this new job. It could be in dating. I mean, I am indeed an expert on this. I'm a certified facial coder. I've done it for 20 years. I know all sorts of experts in the field. But it made for some really interesting dating situations. Some women were fascinated with this. They said, oh, my God, finally, an emotionally literate male. I've been waiting all my life for this. But I remember one other date where I said what I did, and the woman was just horrified. And
I totally get it.
And there are a few ways in which fear shows in the face. One is your eyes go wide. The most reliable indicator is your mouth pulls wide in kind of an egads expression. And that's what she went to immediately. And I went, well, this date is over. And we kept talking for another 15, 20 minutes in the coffee shop, but there was no way we were going out. And, I sat there going the rest of the conversation to myself. I never said anything to her. I said, huh, what is it you're afraid that I'm going to understand about you? Do you have this secret bug where you have to go shopping day and night and you're actually bankrupt? Are you, unfaithful sexually? I mean, what is it that you think I'm going to find out about you? But I do not know, because this was not a very open person, and the prospect of hanging out with me was the worst thing she could imagine.
And you never saw her again.
Never saw her again. You can believe that.
I mean, it's almost like a mind reader. I mean, I could understand how people would be hesitant, like, I don't know if I want to talk with you. You're going to figure things out that I don't want you to figure out.
Sure. Or I'm a tennis player, for instance, and I use it in tennis matches, because you switch sides of the net in between games, and you meet your opponent before the match. I remember one time I was playing doubles. I love to play doubles. And I said to my teammate, I said, the guy on the left side of the court, you're going to discover, is just, his only idea is to pound the ball. Everything's going to be as hard as he can hit it, including right at you at the net. And the reason I picked it up was simply because when he took his racket out of the sleeve where it was held, he got angry because he couldn't open it really easily. And that made him angry, and it made him actually profoundly angry. He got that bulge beneath the middle of his lower lip. I went, just opening your racket and not doing it smoothly makes you that angry? So I was certain that he was going to hit out and hit the ball as hard as he could, and that's exactly how he played the match. Unfortunately, we still couldn't beat them. They were a little better than us, but it was primarily his teammate, who was the more agile player, who brought our defeat around.
Wow. My mind is just flying with all kinds of applications where this could be helpful.
Yeah, no, it's basically endless. I mean, the reason why we have a larger brain, why we have more facial muscles, is because we're social beings. If you go back to understanding when the emotional part of the brain came into evolution, it's essentially when we began to settle down into small villages instead of just wandering the earth. Because at that point, we were starting to interact with people repeatedly and, reading their faces, understanding who they are, who we're dealing with, who you could trust, who liked us. Friend or foe, all of those things really started to kick in. And that's what scientists believe is the point when the brain started to enlarge, and no doubt why those facial muscles are so abundant in people.
Wow. So this must be awful. We're here on a podcast. We can't see each other. We're just audio.
Well, yes.
Big disadvantage.
Yeah, well, I have to work from the voice as well. There's a wonderful study done at UCLA that said that in ambiguous situations, which we have a lot in life, could be a date, a job interview, on and on and on, that about 55% of the true communication comes from the face, but another 38% comes from the voice, and finally just the remaining 7% comes from the words. So, so voice is a great thing. It's much harder to apply voice. You can't readily pick it up with the same signals and manage to identify discreetly, the timbre and the rhythm in ways that help you as much. But you get some kind of gut sense. So, you go there when you have to, of course. But to return to facial coding, I'll give you another instance. It just changes how you read the newspaper. Look at the photographs in the newspaper. Yeah. I remember about, I'm going to say it was 2004, before the surge in Iraq, we have these two generals who are testifying to Congress, and they're claiming that everything is going well.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at the facial expressions of the two generals, and I'm thinking, no, this is not going well. There's no way. They just looked way too uneasy about the stuff they're telling. And, so could be people testifying in front of Congress. It could be, political leaders, prime ministers talking. They're in Holland. I once did a fun segment where I went down to The Hague. And one of your TV stations said, this is your test. I went, oh, my God, what's my test? They said, we have about a minute and a half of videotape of the prime minister and two other political rivals. And we want you to figure out the implications for their personality and their governing style. And I said, well, okay, it depends a little bit on the quality of the video and how much of a, you know, direct shot I can get of seeing their expressions. And they went ahead and played it. And it's your current prime minister in Holland, as well as Wilders, you know, the kind of the right wing guy.
Yeah.
And there was one other person, I can't recall who it was offhand, but they went ahead and they played the video and got done. And they said, what do you see? And who are they? And how do they govern? And I told them what I thought I saw there. And they went, oh my God, that's exactly what is true for these individuals. And it had to be a particularly good video, but it is often true that you can pick up someone's, what I call signature expression or patterns, rather quickly.
Yeah. So what would be one fun, I don't know, party favor? What would be one fun thing you could tell us, like a trick, one tip that we could use, that's sort of an oddball one, or I don't know, not your standard one. What's a fun one?
Well, a fun one, because I was speaking at a conference in Romania, and afterwards one of the two hosts for the conference said, well, we got to try this out a little bit. They said, so go ahead and ask me a question and then tell me what I show in my face. And so to the guy, I said, okay, so what do you think of your mother-in-law?
And what happened?
And a little bit of fear and a little bit of disgust.
Okay. So you got to be careful with your questions.
Yeah.
Who's in the audience.
Yeah. The audience howled with laughter and we all had a good time. And he said, yeah, I'm a little bit intimidated by her, a little bit put off. She's a fairly strong personality. And she looks out for my wife, which is a good thing, but can sometimes mean she finds me wanting a little bit. So it was a fun moment.
Great. Wow. Well, I can just imagine this going endlessly. And it, I mean, is it almost to the point where, you know, well, I don't mean to say this in a negative way, but it's almost like you have a superpower and everybody wants to have the superpower, but then can you turn it off? Because I could imagine you're in a place and you don't feel like dealing with the facial expressions because you don't feel like analyzing it, but maybe you can't even turn it off and you're always doing it.
Well, the only thing I get tired of, I confess, is once people know what I do, they immediately say, so what's on my face? Okay. And so I admit that I'm sure I'm over 10,000 times of being asked that question, even at the post office. So it's just gotten to be a little much. So I don't tend to like to go there. My usual answer is, well, obviously you're a psycho killer. That tends to close down the conversation. But I don't mean to be mean about it. But no, otherwise I don't really turn it off, because even if I'm kind of like, you know, kind of ambling through my day, I might suddenly see an expression somewhere, somehow. It could be on the TV set. It could be passing through an airport and I see someone's expression. Time I actually tried to keep a Delta employee alive. Our flight had been massively delayed out of New York back to Minneapolis. And this person got really irate and I could see him approaching the help desk. And I thought to myself, he's going to try to massacre somebody. Wow. And I would normally never do this, but the most extreme version of anger is when the mouth kind of forms a horizontal funnel. And so the lips are open, but they are tremblingly mad, kind of like a dog whose bone's been taken away from it. Yeah. And he had this expression, which is quite rare, but the flight had been delayed massively. And I saw it and I trailed him up to the desk and I didn't intervene verbally, but just my presence right there watching, I think inhibited him from going off on the employee as much as he might have otherwise.
Wow. So it's life-saving as well.
Yes, it can be. Well, you want to speak about life-saving, I'll give you one more story. So I met with the London police chief. And he said, I believe in facial coding because it saved my life. And I said, well, pray tell, let me know the details. He said, I'm young in my career. I'm in the cell with a murderer. I'm interrogating him. And suddenly, instinctively, I reach out my hand and it's a damn good thing I did, he said, because a man had managed to conceal a knife in the prison cell and he was about to lunge at me and stab me. He said, but I saw that anger around the mouth with the lips pressed together. He said, I saw it just instinctively, intuitively, and I reached my hand out and my hand caught his hand with a knife in it and we wrestled and I, you know, out wrestled him and saved myself.
Wow. All right. Famous Faces Decoded, a guidebook for reading others. Well, there's more to it than meets the eye, pun intended.
There certainly is, yes.
And Dan Hill, thank you so much for being on the show. And this is just fascinating stuff. Where can people find out more about you, about your book? There's your book. It's called Famous Faces Decoded. But you have a couple others, right? Is that your...
I actually have eight other books. I have a book called Two Cheers for Democracy, where I've studied all sorts of foreign leaders as well as American presidents to look for correlations between whether one will be more democratically oriented or more dictatorially oriented. I'm thinking of Orban in Hungary, for instance, who meets my formula for somebody who's more likely to be a dictator. Since the coronavirus has brought around Hungary's democracy being the first victim, he suspended Congress and all Parliament and all of the rules. So I do have that book. I have a book on art called First Blush, where I also used eye tracking to gauge people's intuitive reactions to famous artworks, Rembrandt, Mona Lisa, etc.
Oh, yeah. And you have Decoding Faces.
Well, Decoding Faces was in the earlier draft of this book, I had actually separated out a kind of an application handbook called Decoding Faces from Famous Faces Decoded. But ultimately, I put them both back together, and I put in the celebrity photographs that weren't in the first edition where I used a model, because my attorney, my IP attorney, said, as long as you put the circles and the arrows and stuff to the celebrities' faces, then you can safely use these photographs because you're plugging them in for analytical purposes. So I took that Decoding Faces kind of handy book, and I just worked it back into the main book, so it's all just one piece, because that's, I think, easier and better for people. So anyway, so there is the books. There is my website, which is danhill.sensorylogic.com, sensory logic as in your five senses. I also have a blog series called Faces of the Week, which people can find at emotionswizard.com. And finally, starting in about a year, depending on where you are in the world and how far you want to travel, I'm going to be launching these one-day retreats on EQ and facial coding. Some of them will be business-oriented, but many others will be more personal development-oriented, whether it's you're an artist or just for your marriage and love life, all sorts of applications.
But the retreats are sort of like a how-to, like a workshop?
They are going to be, you know, a little bit of a lecture and workshop. They'd be one-dayers done in the Palm Springs area in California. So you can have a nice setting and then go see Joshua Tree and do some other fun things while you're there. But, you know, they're going to be small enough groups. These are not cattle call occasions. So I want them to be interactive.
Yeah.
So I'm really looking at groups of 25 to no more than 40 people. I want to keep it more intimate. That's simply much more fun and, you know, interactive.
Yeah. Well, real hands-on and see how that could work. Yeah, it'd be a different scene if it were 800 people in a hall.
Yeah, no, I've spoken to as many as 10,000 people on several occasions, and that's an adrenaline rush in its own way. Right. But I think if you're really going to help people, you need to make it, you know, scale it down, make it more personable.
Yeah. Well, this has been fantastic. I just want to hear more, and people can go find out more, but they can find your books. I'll list your websites in our show notes. And thank you so much for being on. This has been just an eye opener. I got to stop with the facial puns, but they're just coming out. Sorry.
That's quite all right. There are lots of them.
I bet. I can see how you get sick of people asking you, well, what am I thinking? But
well, I won't call you two-faced or anything, sadly.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Dan. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
By all means, thanks, Bradley.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.